Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss the politics and science of health and health care. Karen Ann Quinlan was 21 years old when she collapsed after drinking too much alcohol and taking 0.6 of a milligram of aspirin and the tranquilizer Valium at a party in 1975. Although doctors saved her life, she suffered brain damage and lapsed into a persistent vegetative state. Her family began a legal lawsuit for the right to remove her from life support machinery. They succeeded, but Quinlan kept breathing after the respirator was unplugged. She remained in a comatose state for almost 10 years, until she died in 1985. As a result of the Quinlan case, California passed the first living will legislation in 1976, known as the California Natural Death Act. Since then, many states have followed suit to pass legislation ensuring an individual's right to die. When asked, most people will tell you they don't want to die in a hospital. But that's where most people will die. This is the extreme end of a spectrum of possibilities that we face as humans. But as humans, we're social creatures and can communicate our wishes along the way. How do we as healthcare consumers protect our wishes in the face of a complex medical system that believes in intervention? Join us in the next hour as we discuss protecting yourself from the healthcare system. I'm joined by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett, a political economist, a writer and health strategies advisor who works with me on the Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to big box medicine. In addition to his work on the newsletter, he works with people making healthcare decisions, and you can reach him through our website on the consultation page. I think to begin with, it might make sense that we talk a bit about the issue of identifying and protecting your wishes and proclivities, but it might make sense for us to actually go directly to the issue of who it is that you're going to be interacting and what their particular belief system is. So why don't we talk about the issue of managed care, since that's the type of insurance many people are kind of using these days, is a managed care HMO, because I think that the first step in protecting yourself in a healthcare environment is choosing the right insurance policy.
Well, choosing the right insurance policy and understanding how the managed care system is woven into medical practices and hospital practices. We have kind of the egregious situation in the United States that compared to Canada, our administrative costs are 3 times greater than they are in Canada, and that we have financial decisions driving medical decisions. In many cases, physicians will make diagnoses that go into your chart, which then, on the one hand, can be overruled by finance people at managed care facilities, and at the same time become a part of your medical history and can affect your ability to get insurance.
Yeah, I've actually heard stories of people with a diagnosis of flat feet being turned down for insurance. So it's very difficult when you do get a diagnosis. It makes it very hard to shift from one insurance company to another when they raise their rates. What I might say is that in my observation, because if you sit down and actually use a calculator to figure out your medical expenses for the year, it will always be cheaper not to have insurance. Now, I'm not telling people not to have insurance, because if you don't have insurance, you may not get accepted in offices and hospitals. In addition, if you don't have insurance and you have property and something happens to you, your property may be taken from you. So you have to have some form of insurance, but the model that might be worth considering is having an insurance policy that doesn't cover very much, that has a very high deductible, so that your out-of-pocket is as low as possible, but gives you coverage in the event of a catastrophe.
And there are insurance schemes, well, not schemes, setups, so that you have a catastrophic insurance policy, and then you're able to have what is, in essence, a health IRA,
Oh, the medical savings account.
The medical savings account, which is tax deferred savings, so that you can build that up, and that becomes part of what you can use to cover medical costs. But part of the decision here is kind of twofold. Realistically, how much ongoing care do you expect to have? And that's going to be a function of how used you are to taking care of yourself.
Well, except that nobody can control for an accident and
exactly.
an untoward yes. diagnosis of some sort.
That's why the catastrophic coverage is important.
Yeah, and the other thing I would say about that is that if people back down on their insurance coverage, please make sure that you have some kind of coverage for prescription drugs, even if you don't think you'll need them. Because if you get a critical diagnosis and you need coverage for some treatment that you decide to go through with, even if you think you're not that type of person, you may decide in the face of something that you want to have that. And if you don't have any prescription coverage on this policy, they won't cover, and it can ruin you, the cost of pharmaceuticals to treat something. So you're a specialist in how people make decisions and how that works. Let's talk about how physicians make decisions. What kind of, you talked about pattern recognition.
Physicians are, in studies of how physicians make decisions about diagnosing what people have. The discovery is that it's a matter of pattern recognition, that physicians have kind of scripts in their heads of seeing certain patterns. They recognize it as this is angina, this is heart disease, this is Crohn's, this is the list.
Well, isn't it a list of symptoms that leads them to those diagnoses?
It's a list of symptoms of present how you as a patient present, as they say, to the physician, and what the physician literally sees and then recognizes as a disease pattern. This fits into a knowledge base and training that the physician has. And that knowledge base is going to be limited. Now, there's one interesting thing that's been discovered is that this works just fine if your situation is a, quote, normal one for those sets of symptoms. If yours is an unusual case, one thing that was discovered is that experienced physicians do this scripting process, and less experienced physicians will actually go through a careful evaluation of symptoms and go through another decision-making process, and so that the inexperienced physician will more often detect unusual diagnoses than the experienced physician.
Yeah, in defense of physicians, there are certainly physicians who still practice, as we say, the art of medicine. But
yes.
What we find is many of these physicians are not beholden in an aggressive way to insurance policy restrictions on their time and whatnot. So, you know, what I prefer to see and what I look at when I talk to clients is their individual symptoms, what they've been exposed to, and their genetics. You look at the very individual nature of the individual that's sitting in front of you. Because one of the experiences I've had is people calling me and telling me that they've been told that they might have a certain very critical diagnosis, and they've gone to the internet and they've looked this thing up, and sure enough, their symptoms match perfectly. Well, the problem here is that if you go and look at almost any critical diagnosis or chronic diagnosis within certain limits, they
sure.
will look the same. They'll, fatigue, you're cold, you're this, you're that. So it often isn't enough to just go by the symptoms. Sometimes you really have to ask some serious questions, either for yourself or your practitioner, about What sorts of things have you been exposed to? How long have you been experiencing these feelings and symptoms? What kind of family history have you seen in your family? Have you seen some of these things come up? And that may give you a kind of bigger field to work in terms of coming up with something. The other thing is difficult when you're working with a physician as opposed to somebody who's an educator or somebody who has like somebody who does traditional Chinese medicine or homeopathy will take a case and look at even your emotional state, all these other things. With traditional allopathic medicine or less traditional allopathic medicine, what you see is a kind of honing in, as we say, on a diagnosis with the intention of interventions of various sorts. Very often now, they're pharmaceutical interventions. And there are a number of things that can be done before you go to interventions like pharmaceuticals or even using, in some cases, even using an aggressive herbal program, which is to look at your diet, your sleep patterns, food allergies, right. Your gut health. There are things that can be done that are actually quite simple that should be tried first. And the irony is that people often think of doctors as so highly trained and so expert and so experienced that they're afraid to wait. They've been given some piece of information and they're afraid to try something and wait any length of time. So fear is a big driving problem here.
Yeah, part of this is the what you might call the sociology of medical practice, which has developed as a consequence of the germ theory of disease to be about finding the source of your illness as being the result of a specific agent. So that and the art of medicine is really about finding out why it is you experience illness the way that you do, and uncovering that and helping you. The force of most of contemporary allopathic medicine is to find an agent and go after it and find a diagnosis. And without that, for instance, that you may present all of the symptoms of having AIDS, but if you do not have HIV, you will not receive a diagnosis of having AIDS, and treatment may be different and so on. But so there's this search for the diagnosis.
One of the implications of what we're talking about here is that people take a more active role when they approach a healthcare practitioner, that they not go in and hand themselves over to anybody, whether it's an alternative or a conventional practitioner, that they come in considering the person that they're seeing as a resource of information for them, and that they don't lose their center of, for lack of a better word, power, that they stay in their skin and absorb the information and ask critical questions. Now, there's another thing that can go on. I mean, lots of people talk about this business of going into a doctor's office with aberrant symptoms of something that's difficult to diagnose, like maybe Lyme disease, for instance, that goes undiagnosed for long periods of time because it looks like so many other things, and sometimes you don't see the Lyme, the tick bite, is that they're branded as being psychological problems or psychiatric symptoms, and people are not taken seriously. But there's a bigger problem, which is different demographics will cause different assumptions. And you remember me telling you the story of the man that I spoke to on the phone to make an appointment to talk about his hypertension, who in conversation had this out-of-control hypertension, had had it since he was quite young, and had been just treated with diuretics for a long time, and now it was getting higher and higher and higher, and it was getting out of control. And I asked him what he weighed. And he was a tall man, but he weighed 300 pounds. And I said, did anyone ever tell you that losing weight and walking would lower your blood pressure? And he said, no. So I asked him if he was African-American, because that demographic is known to be at risk. And he said, yes. So that means that he was, even though this man is a fairly middle-class person, it wasn't like he came in, he's very educated, presents as a very smart, person, nobody bothered to sort of go over his options. They treated him as though this was inevitable.
And that is not uncommon. It is well known that minorities are evaluated and treated differently, and people in different social classes are evaluated and treated differently. And some of it is quite conscious, and some of it is not conscious. Some of it is elimination of alternatives based on what the physician may or may not think the person is capable of.
The issue here then, as we move ahead, is there's a question of how to choose a healthcare practitioner given the situation. We've talked about insurance. We've talked about if you lock yourself into an HMO, thinking that they're about preventative medicine, that they're going to test you a lot, that that's going to protect you from being at risk without knowing it, that you're going to have lots of health care if you have this. The misguided thought here, in my experience, of looking at people's experience as a health educator is that very often the standard of care that is brittle, that doctors are taught that there's certain research that gets to doctors. The funding for the research comes primarily from pharmaceutical companies. They get information from pharmaceutical reps who come in and teach them about medications. They have pressure from the people paying their bill, these insurance companies, to spend as little time with the patient as possible. And the patient is uncomfortable. So they fall back on this so-called standard of care, which often involves the use of pharmaceuticals. In fact, some doctors are afraid that if they don't prescribe antidepressants, that they will be at risk of losing their license.
Well, standard of care is a two-edged sword. It is the standard by which a physician makes choices about how to treat conditions, but it is also the standard by which they are judged, so that, as you said, if they work outside that standard of care, they are at risk of losing their license, of being reviewed by the medical board. And we know of lots of cases where that has been the case, where innovative practitioners have lost their license.
Yeah, if people don't know about this, one of the most famous cases was many years ago, Dr. Jonathan Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T. His offices were invaded by a sort of SWAT team.
Yeah.
They had guns drawn, and they came in, they closed down his offices, and took all of his injectable vitamin B, B as in boy, vitamin B, the vitamin he was. So many, many doctors who have practiced what we might call alternative medicine are becoming more and more afraid to try alternative treatments, although you can still find them, but they will never be on an insurance policy that you have. If you want to try things that are out of the standard of care, so to speak, you won't get that, even though Kaiser, for instance, to name one specific HMO in California, although they are doing some very interesting innovative programs by including acupuncturists for pain management only and things like that, there is some outreaching to what the consumer has demanded. This is consumer pressure that's caused this to happen. So Kaiser has created a safe environment, as other HMOs have done, created a safe environment for physicians to work and possibly make an actual living instead of having to deal with the billing with the insurance, the other insurers. But they don't actually push or condone anything beyond what is still considered standard of care. So if you, for instance, ask for one more thyroid test beyond their usual, you'll have an argument on your hands. And if you have an educated conversation with your physician and you give them reasons, they will often tell you that they cannot justify doing the test. So they have justifications they have to make to the HMO.
That's the managed care in fact, that was the whole rationale for managed care, that there was this notion that physicians were out of control and insurance companies had no way of controlling costs, so that healthcare costs were skyrocketing. Let's get some financial responsibility that in the process of giving medical care. And HMOs were supposed to be the ideal because they had a built-in incentive to reduce costs while they gave care.
In fact, what they've managed to do is manage to not care. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm in studio with Jeffrey Fawcett, PhD, and we're discussing how to protect yourself in a healthcare environment. And part of what we're mentioning here, part of what we're trying to get through to people, is that your choice of insurance carriers will make a big difference in terms of how you will be handled. Now, many people have said that HMOs have come through for them because they can walk in, they can get appointments and that, but increasingly they're having trouble getting in and they're not able to get the sorts of tests that they want. They're not getting the kinds of flexibility that they need. Women who want to use bioidentical hormones, sometimes they hit a doctor who's willing to do this, sometimes they don't and have to go outside of their system. So I'd urge people, the first step in caring for yourself is to make sure that you have an insurance policy that gives you the flexibility to have, you know, when you're covered by an insurance policy, if you have lab work ordered by a doctor, even though it won't get covered until you meet your deductible, which may be high, you will get the negotiated rate that the insurance company gets. So you will pay half to a third of what the lab tests normally cost. That will help you, and you will have coverage in an emergency situation. But the advantage to having less coverage is that you will then be able to go out of their system and go to whoever you want to go to. And as I said before, if you count up your expenses, you'll still end up paying less if you pay less for your insurance.
Particularly in these days when deductibles are becoming higher and higher, as are premiums.
You know, some time ago, I interviewed the authors of Critical Condition, and I noticed you carried that down to the
yes.
studio here. And it's a book that I would really recommend that people look at if they're interested in getting the background on how all of this came to be. It's a very eye-opening book because what you find out is that the whole setup is a little bit like the Old West. It has that kind of, you know, it's very interesting to read. So I highly recommend the book Critical Condition. Let's move to this idea of identifying your wishes. The first step is to actually know what it is that you believe in, because it doesn't do any good. People very often drag somebody they know into my office to talk to me because they want an alternative view of how to handle, they want a less invasive view of how to handle a certain diagnosis. But the person they're bringing in has a very strong trust of conventional medicine. And
yes.
if that's the case, you can still navigate the healthcare system. You can still do that. But you need to be not passive. You need to be involved.
Yes. Well, certainly one of the first things to, even if you want to remain within the bosom of the conventional healthcare system, is to make sure that you demand to know what the alternatives are.
Yeah, although I find demanding is not a very good way to come forward.
That you stand up for your interests.
Yeah.
That and understand that for the most part, physicians, the people who are working in that system, actually do want to make you well, and that if you take the attitude that you are working with them, you'll generally get a good response.
Yeah, my experience is that there's a real difference. It varies. Some doctors, if you come in and you've researched the situation and you come in with a lot of research and you know something about it, some doctors will like this and appreciate it, and other doctors will be angry. So one of the first steps is that when you're looking at who you're going to go to, it's always a good idea to call the office and, in fact, kind of assess how the front desk works. in any given situation. Are you going to be able to reach people and navigate that system? Because increasingly, they're a little too protective, or they're doing too much guardianship. They're very much gatekeepers. So you have to see whether or not you're going to be able to get a lab test done, or if you get a call, you'll be able to get your results and this and that. The other thing to ask is, of the proclivities that you have, for instance, as an example, if you're interested in bioidentical hormone replacement, you want to use non-patented things, you want to use these low-dose hormones, and you have an idea of what you want. You've been reading Dr. Lee's book, or you've done a consultation with somebody who knows, and you've done the educational stuff. Call the office and ask whether the doctor uses compounding pharmacies, whether or not the doctor is comfortable with bioidentical hormones. If you're looking at needing some help from an oncologist, call the office and ask the nurses or the receptionists how flexible the attitude of this physician is. I mean, know that if you're going to a surgeon is going to tell you to cut. If you go to a radiologist, the radiologist is going to tell you to do radiation. So you have to know ahead of time kind of which direction you're going in, and then ask how patient they are about the mention or the discussion of alternatives.
And that means you have to do some homework. These litmus tests are extremely useful if you are looking for a physician. The other point to emphasize here is you have a right, you have a constitutional right, by the way, to direct your own health care. Your physician may refuse to treat you as you ask. If you want bioidentical hormones and the physician that you're working with does not believe in using them, you need to move on to another physician. But you can insist that your wishes are respected.
Well, this is important to know, because, and I'd like you to say more about it. But, you're sure that this is protected under constitutional rights?
Yes. You have the constitutional right under, if I remember it right, the case is called Cruzan versus Webster. And it was decided in the 70s around a care case, and it was essentially a conflict between medical practitioners who wanted to follow one course of action and a patient who wanted to follow another course of action. And the Supreme Court found that in the patient's favor, that there is a constitutional right that you can direct your own health care. And it's the basis for a lot of what we're going to be talking about later, which is establishing medical directives and proxies.
The other thing that's very difficult for people is to get their lab results.
Oh.
And this is interesting, because a doctor who's cooperating with you, if you just say to them, will you please ask the lab to fax results to me and to mail results to me as well as to you, the doctor will say yes, and it'll be there. And then when you go in to get your blood drawn, make sure that that's there. But most doctors have no problems with you receiving the results. And in contrast, there are offices who will not only there's a full span here. One is that they don't want to send you your records at all, or that they charge you for copying them. You have every right in the world to ask that the lab send you the results as well. You should always keep a file of your own lab work at home for yourself.
And that's another constant. Well, at least in California, it's a constitutional right.
Yeah. We're going to need to take a brief musical break. I am Lena Berman, and I'm in studio with Jeffrey Fawcett, PhD, and we're discussing protecting yourself in a healthcare environment. If you stay tuned after this musical break, we'll begin to talk about how to establish your wishes, how to document them, how to choose a proxy, and how to write a medical directive. So please stay with us. This is your own health and fitness, and we'll be right back. Thank you. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I'm in studio with Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett, and we're talking about how to protect yourself in a healthcare environment. If people want to reach Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett, he is a health strategies advisor and a writer, and you can find information on how to get in touch with him at yourownhealthandfitness.com, our website, at the consultation page. In addition, on the website, you can find out about who our guests are, what our shows are about, how to order tapes and CDs, and information on the Progressive Health Observer, which Dr. Fawcett works on with me, the news commentary alternative to big box medicine. If you don't have a computer, you can call my information number 24 hours at 707-874-2772, and Dr. Fawcett's number is 707-874-1496. So just to recap very briefly, what we're really saying to people is that the normal kind of, the way in which doctors have been set up as experts, and there's no question that doctors are in some way, they've studied and they've worked very hard to get where they are. But the kind of medical establishment we have in this country rewards doctors with money, and doctors are very often very short of money by the time they finish medical school. They're very tight on time. The insurance companies are an issue. People need to be very careful what kind of insurance plan they're on so that they have enough freedom to make healthcare decisions for themselves. And they need people in general, what we're begging people to do is to interact with their practitioners and shop for them and ask very pointed questions. Now, before we move on to healthcare directives and things like that, I want to talk a bit about one of the big issues that comes up. We've in fact done a show on this, which is the idea of cancer screening and lots of testing. One of the decisions you have to make when you decide to do cancer screening, well, obviously one decision you want to make is whether the procedure that you're about to do is invasive, and if you're using any kind of radiation, that includes bone density tests, I might add.
Yes.
Any amount of radiation that you're exposed to is unsafe. Now, there may be reasons to use radiation if you've been hit by a truck or if you have a critical diagnosis and they can't do an MRI and they can't do an ultrasound, and your only option is to use radiation, you have a broken bone, you have to make an educated decision about that. If you can avoid having a CAT scan, you should. A CAT scan will expose you to approximately the amount of radiation that you get that people who were a mile and a half from ground zero in Hiroshima were exposed to. It's an enormous amount. Fluoroscopies are equally high. So those two procedures, if anything else can be done, should be done instead. Radiation is cancer provocative. It does provoke, does stimulate cancer development, and it has also been shown to damage the heart muscle. This, all the research of John Goffman, G-O-F-M-A-N, you can look on the website for him under shows by guest. He is a remarkable researcher and has, there's no question about this. So, but let's say that you want a colonoscopy or you want something else, some other scan, or even your mammogram, which is a low dose, is a low dose of radiation, or any of the prostate specific antigen tests or any of these others, it's very important that you know a good deal about the testing procedure itself. There's a very good book called Should I Be Tested for Cancer? Maybe Not, and Here's Why. Again, you can look on the website for that show. This is Dr. Welsh, W-E-L-S-H, I believe.
C-H.
Welsh, like grape stuff. And the main question that you need to ask yourself, along with what are the risks of the procedure, because many procedures like angioplasty, for instance, can rupture a valve. There's even been research that shows that colonoscopies can't be cleaned very well. But the biggest question is, what do you do if in the midst of the procedure they take something off of you and take it to the path lab and it's positive? If it's a colonoscopy, they will want to roll you into the OR and open your abdomen. You have to know ahead of time what your willing to do if you do this procedure. Now, I want to mention also that there are other ways to look for cancer. There is a test called, there's a blood test called the anti-malignant antibody test. It's not used a lot, so sometimes it will be ordered incorrectly. It's an AMAS test, anti-malignant antibody. I think it's S at the end. Oncolabs, O-N-C-O, Oncolabs is the company that does the best job on this, but it is testing for cell proliferation, and it can be done to either back up a cancer diagnosis that you suspect but I'm not sure of before doing something invasive. The ones through Oncolabs, I have been told by people I respect, are good, well, a good way to test for generalized cell proliferation. And if you find it and you know what your family history is, then you can go ahead and have a more invasive test. But you need to know what you're willing to do ahead of time if they find something.
Well, to back up some, one of the virtues of the Welch book, in addition to having a lot of really good information about cancer diagnostics, is to point to the fact that there is, as unfortunately is true in a good deal of our culture, the force of fear is a big force here. And what Welch is part of is a movement among physicians who see too much diagnosis and too much treatment, overdiagnosis, overtreatment. And what his book is about, although it's focused on cancer, more broadly it's about do you really need to be diagnosed? Is what's going on sufficient that we have to be worried? And do we have to act? There is this force that if you diagnose, if you test, you diagnose, you treat. And what you have to do is to decide how much you want to be pushed by that force of fear. The other part, to reinforce what you've already said, Lena, is that is to understand, if you do have the test, what are the consequences? And again, that's a matter of asking a physician, what are the possible outcomes here once you do the diagnosis, and what are you prepared to do if a test comes back positive?
Well, the other thing is that one of the reasons for not for testing, what Welch says is that if you wait for, now I want to say, I'm halting because I want to be careful how this comes out. I'm not advocating that people who have, there are some cancers that are very hard to detect. Colon cancer is, for instance, but what I'm trying to say is that you don't ignore symptoms. But if you're a healthy person who hasn't got a really scary genetic line with something in it, if you're really doing well and you're healthy, there's a question about whether you should be looking for cancer in a healthy individual, or whether you should wait for for some symptoms. Now, when you have symptoms, your cancer is advanced, and there may not be a lot to do. But when you look at some of the research about cancer and diagnosis, what you find is that some of these really early diagnoses are not they're not predictive of how long someone will live. In other words, somebody treated early for cancer may not survive longer than somebody who waited for a palpable lump in their breast or some other symptom. Now, there are situations with certain kinds of cancers like lung cancer where if you don't have small cell and it's caught early, you may be able to survive, and you wouldn't if it got... So there's a delicate line. But it brings up an important question about whether extremely healthy people without risk factors should be constantly tested all the time, because it increases your risks of being overtreated for a cancer that might not ever really develop, or something that isn't really a cancer, it's just a precursor, some cell changes that, diet and exercise. Now, this said, if you are leading a a provocative lifestyle, and by that I mean you've been exposed to a significant amount of chemical exposure. You live right next to a golf course, or you work in grape arbors. You have the unfortunate problem of working around agricultural industry with pesticides, or you live next to an orchard that had something like the pesticide with the M,
methylbromide.
Methylbromide. You know, where you see plastic on the field or something, or you've worked in industry where you've been exposed to it, or you smoked most of your life. You took birth control pills and you smoked. Any of the sort of risk factors, if you know yourself to be at risk and you know your family risk is there, you still might want to get something like an AMAS test instead of doing invasive tests. But in the end, you have to decide whether you're willing to do really invasive treatment, especially early, or whether you're willing to do a watch and wait. And that means that you have to ask people, doctors and researchers, very important questions. And why don't you talk a bit about the questions?
Well, the first and most obvious question is, how aggressive are any one of these cancers? That is, how sensible is a watch and wait strategy?
This is if you found something.
If you are symptomatic. If, for instance, on men, if your prostate is enlarged, should we be doing biopsies? And what can we find? If we're doing biopsies as opposed to doing simply watch and wait. One of the interesting things that I wrote an article about in the Progressive Health Observer was the new standards for PSA tests and how a shift in Europe to a watch and wait strategy actually reduced the amount of treatment and surgery that was performed on men.
Yeah, because treatments can kill people.
Treatments can kill people. They can dislodge. And I wrote another article on mammograms. There's a
problem.
There's a controversy in just the conventional literature over whether mammograms, regular routine mammograms for middle-aged women, prevent cancer deaths, and the studies that I've seen suggest that they don't. And the reason for that is that many of these small cancers that are found go away.
Yeah, although I want to make a point here, which is that I don't think that if you find something, a palpable lump, you have prostate enlargement, you have bowel symptoms, that you ignore what's going on, which I have seen people do. I've had them understand what I'm saying to mean denial instead of treatment. And treatment in this case is going to talk, this is not today's show, but it would be aggressive nutrient interventions.
Yes.
It would be very specific styles in the way that you take care of your life and how much rest you get, how much stress you're exposed to. I mean, really important decisions. You really do have to use any of this stuff as a wake-up call, but you also have to ask the right questions to your practitioners. And the first one you just said is, what happens if I wait this length of time or that length of time? Because when you get some kind of diagnosis, it's like a train coming at you full speed. They want to rush you into treatment.
That's right. That's the force. Because that's, God bless them, that's what they do. That's what they're trained to do. They're trained to bring you back to health, or they're trained to eliminate disease, the source of disease. So if they see a source of disease, they will treat it. And if they find it, the more delicate or the more minute the examination for finding, the more treatment there will be. And that's part of this movement, as I said, that Welch and others are involved in, of let's slow down here and maybe we don't have to do all the diagnostic tests that we're doing, that we should be more careful. The other set of questions, of course, to ask is not only how aggressive is this condition, whatever it might be, what are the risks associated with it, but what are the risks associated with all of the possible treatments, and what are the risks associated with those?
I had an experience recently of visiting a really old friend of mine who is just going to turn 89 in August. And it's interesting that, like my own father, he has a damaged heart valve from an early illness as a child. And now at his age, the valve is closing down and he's having a lot of heart stuff. And he's making choices along the way. Well, he was having trouble sleeping. And, of course, they took him off to a sleep center and he rejected having a sleep mask. He said, look, I'm old, I'm tired, I don't want to do this. But one of the first things that happened when he was at the cardiologist's is that a young surgeon came in and was coming at he and his wife about how they could open him up and do open heart surgery and fix the valve. And, most physicians won't do this on somebody whose aortic valve is closed down because the anesthesia will kill them. So the likelihood that they'll survive an operation like that, and that powerful an operation at that age, is very slight. And Jesse said, I don't want to do that. And the doctor kept saying, this is what I do. I'm really good at this. This is what I do. I have great success. This is my job, and this is what I do. And Jesse said, yes, but I don't want to do this. So, there's something about knowing when it's time to kind of just have some quality of life and leave, have these people not coming at you and take a risk that your treatment will be the end of you. It's also this going back to taking care of situations with the non-invasive treatments first and adjusting the diet and the supplements and things like that.
Well, there's another question that is... That slips in here too, which is you have a diagnostic test, it comes back positive, bad news, is to ask the question about false positives. And false positive is the test says you have cancer, but in fact you do not. Now, physicians are not trained as statisticians, and false positives are in essence a statistical phenomenon. So physicians will often say, oh, yes, it's a very good test to have high degree of confidence. The way to ask the question about false positive is, in your experience, how often does it occur that a test comes back positive and, in fact, the person does not have the condition? That's different than the statistical question about confidence and do you feel good about that, the test being telling you what's going on. So false positives is something to keep in mind.
And what are we going to do if we do this test and we get a certain diagnosis? What do we do next? And then you get to think about whether you want to do that.
Yes.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health educator Lena Berman, and I'm in the studio with political economist and writer Jeffrey Fawcett, PhD. We're discussing how to protect yourself in a healthcare environment. Before we move on to healthcare directives, I want to just say one thing, which is always, if you're having some serious health problems, always have someone go with you to the doctor. Don't go alone.
Yes. Yeah.
And never go into a hospital without having someone watch over you.
Oh, yeah.
Under any circumstances, the incidence of staph infections, of mistakes, there are stories in critical condition about people using a Sharpie to write if they have something is being removed, to have it written on their body, take this over here, don't take this.
Yes.
Because of mistakes. Moving on to the healthcare directive, why don't you give people some kind of overview of what the different issues are here and what different documents you need and how to proceed?
Well, in the current context is end of life situations. As I mentioned earlier, you have a constitutional right that as long as you can communicate, you can direct your own health care, and that means firing the doctor, firing the hospital, as difficult as that may be under some circumstances, but you have the right to direct your own medical care. So health directives and all the things that are associated with them are really for end-of-life situations, and end-of-life means either that you have a terminal diagnosis that doctors say you have a very short time to live, and short time to live varies from state to state.
Really?
But, yes. Yes, what exactly that means. But basically it means you're suffering from a terminal illness, and you're not expected to survive. You're going to die in days to weeks.
Or
you are in a what is called a permanent, or you're in a coma.
Or you have an accident.
Or you have, yeah. Well, it's you have an accident and you're not expected to survive. So those are two different conditions. One, you may be conscious or semi-conscious. You may come back. For instance, the Terri Schiavo situation was one where technically she was not. She would come back to alertness. Her eyes would open. She would be responsive. Whereas when you're in a coma, you are not. But medical directives pertain to both situations. And now medical directives are different from do not resuscitate orders, which have to do with whether CPR is heroic efforts are made to get your heart and your breathing going again after they've stopped. Associated with the medical directive is assignment of someone who is a proxy who, when you are incapable of communicating yourself, of making decisions for you. The medical directive and the proxy are often two documents that are together, kept together, they're fairly simple documents. The medical directive actually is this was a kind of a surprise, although it makes perfectly good sense that the actual legal form of them, the actual wording, differs from state to state. But the essence of a medical directive is that you clearly communicate what you do and do not want to have done to you to preserve life, to keep you alive. That is the core of this whole process. So it's about communicating what you want. So there's one piece of it, which is putting it into a legal format. And to make a plug, Nolo Press has two products that can put these things together very easily for you, and it also has legal advice as to what these things may mean, what your choices are, and how to make them. In addition to putting together these legal documents, it's also critical for you to both communicate with your family and with your proxy and with your family physician, if you have one, that to make clear what your wishes are. There's another kind of more narrative document that is a good idea for you to write, which is would be part of this documentation, which is it describes more the quality of how people should make decisions about what you want, what your wishes are, and the quality of life and the quality of death that you want. And that doesn't have to be, that is not a formal document.
And to give people some idea, in the book Talking About Death by Virginia Morris, Morris, Talking About Death, another show I did, she actually has in the book a sample of one of these narratives, and it was written by a man who was getting close to the end of his life with AIDS, and what he said was, if I have no reasonable chance of recovering to the point of being able to communicate, let me go. And that, you know, so everyone has to find their own words, but that was a way of saying where the line is. Now, this is all keeping in mind that people never want to do this. You and I finally sat down and said, okay, we're going to do this now, but it's obvious from the news that this is important to have done early, and the assignment of a proxy and the discussions with other people and distributing these documents. My impression is that you do not need, it sounds like the do not resuscitate order, which would be more an issue if you were terminally ill, although it might be important to have it around just in case something happens, but if you're really toward the end of life, do not resuscitate, versus the fact that if you have an accident and you're, you know, have a reasonable chance of recovery, please, right. yes, do resuscitate.
Yes.
That has to be signed by a physician.
That's correct.
But the power of attorney is signing someone to be your proxy. Do you need a lawyer?
Not unless what you want is complicated.
And involves financial stuff.
And involves... Well, the financial stuff can be done by establishing a separate power of attorney for finance. There is a power of attorney for health care and a power of attorney for finance, two separate things. But that is, the financial part is also something to consider, that if you are in a state where you can't communicate effectively and your life is sustained, how do you want your finances to be to be handled?
Yeah. Now, you can hire a writer to write these documents for you if you just don't want to deal with it yourself, or you can go to NOLO Press. I called and interviewed by phone Dr. Alan Barron, who is a ER doc that I know with lots of experience. And what he told me is that in senior centers, they dispense a form which is printed on golden paper. And the paramedics will look for this form in any house that they go into, old or not, in the freezer. So keep a copy of this in the freezer so the paramedics can find it. Keep a card in your wallet with the name of your doctor and your proxy and who you want contacted. Make sure you don't leave the house with that in your wallet. And basically what he said is that doctors will resuscitate you and try to keep you alive, but they will also try to contact people to find out what your wishes are. But they will try to save your life in the beginning. But do keep a document in your freezer, and make sure all your loved ones and all the people that are connected to you have copies of these documents as well. We're completely out of time. I hope this was helpful to you. This is Lena Berman, and thank you, Dr. Fawcett.
Thank you.
For being here with me in the studio. If you want to, and I thank you all for listening as well, if you need information or if you want a cassette copy of this or any other in the series Your Own Health and Fitness by CD or cassette, you can call my information number 24 hours at 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows or information about guests and contact information about guests, go to the website yourownhealthandfitness.com, where you can also find Dr. Fawcett's information on the consultation page. Also information on subscribing to the new newsletter, Progressive Health Observer. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness, 8.5x11 Productions, and KPFA-FM. The engineer for Your Own Health and Fitness is Eddie Pay. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.